Welcome into Redacted, everybody. Thank you for holding tight and being with us this Monday. You have joined us on the 10th of July. By us, you probably could see Grover just walk in. That's the dog, Grover the dog. I'm Natalie Morris. Clayton Morris is still out. He's out for the rest of the week. So you've got me just for 1 week longer, and then you'll have him back. I appreciate all your words of support and all of your words of missing Clayton. I think that means a lot to him. He's doing fine. But he has just another week off and then he's back in the saddle, back to the races. We have a lot to talk about though today. We have war update. The United States is talking about sending cluster bombs. I guess if there's a silver lining to all of this, at least we can get rid of this notion of precision strike. That never was a thing. We can at least be real about the destructive cost of war in terms of human lives, but it's not a pretty picture, and I'm going to show it to you later in the show. The Prime Minister of the Netherlands resigned all of a sudden under kind of fishy explanation. We have Ralf Schollheimer here to explain what's this about, because the official explanation doesn't hold water. Let us know what you think about that. Plus, we are going to be talking about what is that? Oh, the movie, The Sound of Freedom. I was like, is that a censorship story? Yes. What does the left want to hide from you? Why don't they want you to see this movie, Sound of Freedom? We're going to have to be really careful about this one because this is a movie about child trafficking and human trafficking. I want to warn you in advance, don't go Googling anything unsafely. If you're looking for the movie, make sure you look up only the movie if you're getting movie tickets. This is just, it feels like a trap probably because it is, and we're going to talk about that. Plus, the trans rally in London this week had a spokesperson that was a convicted felon, attempted murderer, calling for punching women straight in the face. It's a biological man in the streets calling to punch women. That's okay, though. Because they're in woman face. We're going to bring you that story as well. All of that and more as Redacted starts right now. All right, welcome back to your Monday. If you had last week off for the holiday, we appreciate you coming back, getting back to work, getting back in the saddle. I'm working. I appreciate you being here with us. Hey, we have a daily newsletter. That also has continued, even with a party of one here at the Redacted headquarters, which is just our house and me. Our newsletter can be found at redacted.inc. It's a free newsletter. We really appreciate your subscription. We bring you a lot of the stories that we propose to you on this show, not propose, that we present to you on this show, plus more tidbits and other information like daily stock updates, Bitcoin prices. All of that stuff comes to you for free with just a subscription. Also, it is a place to find original sources for all of the stories we talk to. Great thing for you to save because a lot of times these stories we present to you, the media either just erases them or forgets they exist when they decide to change the narrative for whatever suits their purposes. So redacted.inc is where you can find the newsletter. We also have Philip is my producer working with me today, furiously
hello.
Pushing buttons and bringing us screens and moving all the things on the screen that are not me talking. We really appreciate him. David is with us again today, but he's in and out. He has some kind of system issues, and so I don't know if he's going to chime in or not. If he does, we really appreciate his contributions. Sometimes he just surprises us. He keeps us on his toes. I think for now he is not there. So, shall we get going? Everybody ready? Grover dog? He's good. Okay, are you good? Settle in because it's time. President Biden is in Europe this week for a NATO meeting, but he made a stopover in London today to meet with the Prime Minister and the King. Now, royal protocol is not the most important thing in the world, but I think media narratives are important. So I just want to sort of kick this one off with a sort of lighter topic. Do you remember this headline about President Trump walking with the Queen in 2018? saying that he caused social media flurry because he walked in front of the Queen. At the time, the headlines were fast and furious about how he didn't know what he was doing. He broke social etiquette. He embarrassed United States of America, all of that stuff. Well, here is a video of when President Trump walked with Queen Elizabeth and for a moment, again, walked in front of her. All right. So that was the social faux pas that the media freaked out about in 2018. Well, here is today President Biden walking with the king. All right. So obviously, in terms of protocol, President Biden's behavior is a bigger faux pas, wouldn't you say, if you care about this sort of thing. Philip put them side by side so we can see the two men. Now, again, I'm not telling you one is worse than the other, but the media freaked out about Trump, who was in front of the Queen for about 3 seconds before he let her come around the side. President Biden seems to not even know where he is in life. So will the media and the internet point out now how Biden is not with it the way that they did with Trump? Probably not, because they like to pretend he's totally fine and with it. He is not. Here's a video that surfaced this weekend of him from a tribute to Vera Wang, which happened in March of this year.
Included groundbreaking Asian Americans like Vera Wang and Joan Shingang, I'm going to pronounce her, Shanga Kawawa.
That was hard to watch. Okay, so now that we've established who we're dealing with here, now we're talking about that person making decisions about global warfare. Okay, everyone feel better. He is deciding the future of the war in Ukraine at the NATO summit in Lithuania, which starts tomorrow. We're going to get to that summit in a minute. But one of the main issues that matters to the world is Ukraine and whether or not they will be allowed into NATO. It's my opinion they should not, because NATO is a creator of war, but we'll talk more about that later. What Western leaders have warned is that they don't want Ukraine in this bloc or in the European Union for years, because they know that Ukraine is, one, deeply in debt. In 2014, recall that the IMF did not want to loan any more money to Ukraine while they were waging an $8 million a day war on the Donbas, which now they no longer control, but they want back to continue that $8 million a day war. Is that a good investment, do you think? Western leaders also knew and know that Ukraine is deeply corrupt and will never stop waging this war on the Donbas, whether Russia is there or not. And the Western press knew this until they decided to pretend that they don't. Now, Zelensky's threatened to not show up for the cameras if Ukraine is not allowed a full membership in NATO. I don't think he really means it. There's no way that guy is going to step away from the cameras. But President Biden spoke about Ukraine's NATO membership on CNN this weekend, and he said, basically, not now. Listen.
I don't think there is unanimity in NATO about whether or not to bring Ukraine into the NATO family now, at this moment, in the middle of a war. For example, if you did that, then, you know, we're determined to commit every inch of territory that is NATO territory. It's a commitment that we've all made, no matter what. If the war is going on, then we're all in the war.
This is actually the most logical thing he said about Ukraine in a very long time. If you admit a country into NATO that's at war, then every other country is at war. And I was even shocked that CNN bothered to show that map of the NATO countries that would be dragged into a war. They usually don't do this. He said that Putin had been hoping he could break NATO. Never mind that Russia actually applied to become a member of NATO in the 90s and was blackballed by the Bush administration. Also that Russia was the first to offer the U.S. the use of military bases after 9/11. But okay. But this means that we don't want to be dragged into a war. But this argument is kind of bad faith, given the fact that Biden is leading this war and the United States forces behind whoever's really making the decisions, because it doesn't seem like it's President Biden, although he did seem coherent-ish in that CNN interview. You know, I watched, I was like, is that the same guy who then, you know, is this perpetual, I don't know where I am, squint? Seems to be. But the U.S. is pressuring Europe to support Ukraine. The U.S. is dragging the war on and is sabotaging peace talks. This was just last month. Remember, Secretary of State Antony Blinken warned against peace. So NATO doesn't want peace. The United States is going there to make sure other allied NATO members also don't want peace. We're going to take a look this week at the agenda of what they're going to be talking about. But NATO members are said to be working on some sort of junior varsity agreement with Ukraine. So it's not really an assurance that they'll be members, but just that they're going to have their back.
Like a mascot. It's like NATO's mascot. You can be our mascot. You're not official. Yes. You're not an official member, but we'll put you out in front of the cameras and you can smile and wave. Ukraine is NATO's mascot, I guess.
That's a good one. Yeah. I like that. Not necessarily JV, but it's like you wear the suit, right? Dance in front of the cameras, which, again, we know that Ukraine is going to continue to do. You know, according to Politico, it says world leaders in NATO are trying to create an umbrella for all countries willing to provide Ukraine with ongoing military aid, even if the details vary from country to country. I don't know what that means. An umbrella. I guess. Yeah. The only thing I could do with that imagery is kind of flip it upside down. And then you can think maybe a funnel where like everyone puts in a little bit and it funnels. I don't understand at all this idea of an umbrella. And Politico did no favors in trying to explain it. Meanwhile, the U.S. has said that it is willing to send cluster bombs to Ukraine. These are small bombs that kill indiscriminately. According to the BBC, even U.S. allies have expressed unease about this. Let's watch this piece from Al Jazeera to remind ourselves what it is we're dealing with if we up the ante to cluster bombs.
These cluster bombs are considered so dangerous, they've been banned by more than 120 countries. But the U.S. says they'll be included in a new military aid package to Ukraine. Neither have joined the convention banning their use, nor has Russia.
Mr. President, cluster munitions, why now?
We've run out of ammunition.
So just how dangerous are they? The missile canisters contain hundreds of smaller bombs that spread out in the air. This means they are indiscriminate and can have a widespread and devastating impact. The International Committee of the Red Cross says as many as 40% of the bomblets fail to detonate and can pose a threat to civilians decades later. Human Rights Watch accuses Ukraine and Russia of killing civilians with cluster weapons.
All right. So in that piece, when the president is walking out of a room that's like playing band music, they say, why are you doing this now? And he says, we've run out of ammunition. Well, OK. Is that true? Because we've seen them continuously ordered more from weapons makers. Is this really like we're cleaning out the closet? We just don't have anything else. So then you would think maybe then we stop, or maybe this is a time to Does that explanation hold any water to the rest of us? And like, why would you, if it's true, why would you say it in public? Because the enemy could hear you and they think, oh, well, this is all you've got left. I can't buy that. I absolutely can't buy that. Now, remember, we started reporting about cluster bombs back in December. Do you remember this? This was in Dave DeCamp says, really? Like all cluster bombs do is make sure more civilians are killed because cluster bombs are indiscriminate. And in March, Republican lawmakers said, oh, yeah, this sounds like a great idea. Look at this. Republican lawmakers pressed Biden to send cluster bombs. Why do they want this so badly? Why would they think that this is an awesome idea? Given that the counteroffensive is all but dead installed, given that maybe we really don't have anything else. Do we really want to clean out the closet and send these, which have a 40% fail rate and then can linger around and kill people later? Who there is thinking, this is going to win? This is the ticket we haven't tried. This is the winning tactic, these cluster bombs. And now that the U.S. seems to have acquiesced to this idea, cluster bombs, again, are banned by many countries. and are against humanitarian laws, according to the United Nations. The one thing I can think about, though, about this is at the very least, it helps to sort of get rid of this idea of precision strike. This is a propaganda term that was used a lot by the Obama administration, and I think even conceived of during the Obama administration. This idea that you can target exactly who you want and have no collateral damage is a lie. It's something that, you know, spokespeople for the government will say, oh, yes, we took out just that target. And everyone else around them was totally fine. We know that's not true from the first WikiLeaks in 2010 from Julian Assange. This is what U.S. Army Colonel Amos Fox coined the term precision paradox. This is about the U.S. war on ISIS, but it continues to be something that we as media consumers have to fight against. It's like this idea that there's a situation in which the failed promise of precision strikes, that is one strike, one kill, generates a creeping wave of destruction. So if you can buy into precision strikes as a thing, you sort of let it go by you. Like, that's fine. That's fine too. Take out that terrorist. Don't hurt that village. Take out that terrorist. No civilians killed. Like it. Moving on. Next click, right? And it's not true. It's just how we swallow terrible things and how we are, the truth is kept from us that civilians are harmed and communities destroyed by warfare. So at least, is this a silver lining? I don't know. I mean, I hate to even present it at this. At the very least, if the West is talking about cluster bombs, you know that the destruction is going to be widespread. And this sort of bull crap about precision strike is gone, right? We don't have to pretend.
Well, if we end up in this like perpetual war and now we're sending cluster bombs because we're out of ammunition, what do we send when we run out of cluster bombs? I mean, are we just going to have to be like, well, I know we've got all of these like chemical weapons around that we're not supposed to use, yeah, but we're out of cluster bombs.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like,
that's like the, I don't know, the last thing left in your pantry. What's the last thing left in your pantry, you guys, if you weren't going to eat anything else? Like canned salmon.
Like, I imagine the last thing the thing we'd end up with is like, what, mustard gas? You know, end up just with, you know, throwing cyanide gas out there and be like, yeah, but we're out of everything else.
Yeah.
And it's still not over. So, I mean, it's just ridiculous.
So, I mean, peace is never an option here. We don't have it. We know civilians will be killed, but like, we're to the back of the cupboard. So the cupboards are bare now. We have to then eat what's left there. Yeah. Biological weapons, right? We already have infodemics, informational weaponry. So then what's next? I mean, you know, is it a silver lining now that they're not insulting our intelligence with this lie about precision strikes? Or is it just like, oh, well, you know, more groups of people will be killed and that will help us to, because is it like a widening of the scope of acceptability, right? We accepted precision strikes. Now we're accepting small groups of kills. Will that just be widening until we're just like entire generations, right? Is it that we're accepting? I don't know. Let me know what you think of this in the chat and whether or not the United States is, I mean, it's, if you're a tax U.S. taxpayer like me, passport holder, you're paying for this. This is on your dime. But you know, you have paid for it already. They exist. If that's what they, you know, if this is what's left, this is what we got, right? We paid for it. It's a sunk cost. So I guess the government has decided they might as well use it since it's there, since they bought it. Again, like eating out of the back of the pantry. So let us know what you think of that in the chat, whether or not you think that this is something the United States is actually going to do, whether they should do it, whether or not this rhetoric around NATO will continue to sort of, yeah, let Ukraine be the mascot, but not really allow them in, whether any of this is heading towards peace. Nothing I've said today gives me any kind of encouragement about peace that is forthcoming, but if you can see any there, let me know. All right. Well, we have more to get to today. We're going to talk about this sudden resignation of the prime minister in the Netherlands. It seems like he is following the pathway of Jacinda Ardern. So we're going to break that down with journalist and analyst Ralph Scholheimer. But first, we want to tell you about our friends. Oh, and also we're going to talk about, sorry, The Sound of Freedom, this movie they don't want you to see. I'm sorry, Philip. No, not that. This.
That's okay.
Let me get it straight. We're going to talk about The Sound of Freedom, the movie that the left says you can't see it, even though there's truth to it, because if you do, it validates QAnon. It's the craziest stinking thing I've ever heard. There's truth there. It's pretty terrible for some people. But if it validates any part of an ideology, we can't be bothered with that. So just only be afraid of the things we tell you to. And child trafficking, we'd like you to know, is not on the priority list. Please go back to freaking out about COVID, basically. Plus, we're going to show you who this sort of spokesperson for the trans rally this weekend in London is, why that person may be a little bit problematic. If you're going to lead a movement, a big human rights movement, maybe this is not the person you choose. And why that might seem to be problematic and what the reaction is to that. But first, we want to tell you about our friends over at MedCline, because if you know someone who struggled with acid reflux and how they've just been unable to sleep, maybe they've tried everything, medication, diet change, but nothing helps, you should tell them about MedCline, because this is a sleep solution. It's actually a medical device that can help you with all manner of sleep uncomfortabilities, such as shoulder pain. Look, I think the woman in the middle there is pregnant, and it can help you as in a maternity pillow solution. Also helps with acid reflux as well because of this incline. It's really a pillow kind of bedding system that allows for any kind of position that you like to sleep in. I sleep on my side, and if I don't have this MedCline, then my shoulder goes to sleep because of sort of the weight of my body. So I find it really, really helpful. In fact, 95% of patients reported an overall improvement in sleep quality when using MedCline. So visit their website and see all the different ways that you can sleep. And especially for me, I find it that it just keeps me in one spot and helps to sort of, I put it between my knees to elevate the space between my hips. And I find it great for that. So right now you can get 20% off when you go to medcline.com/redacted. Once again, you get 20% off plus a better night's sleep if you go to medcline.com/redacted. Again, check them out. Find the best product to help relieve your nighttime pain and truly sleep better. Once again, that's medcline.com/redacted. Well, the Prime Minister of the Netherlands, Mark Rutte, has resigned, saying that he's leaving politics altogether. He's been in office since 2010, making him one of the longest running officials in the European Union. Now, this follows a fallout over immigration. He had been hoping to limit the flow of immigration and asylum seekers, but was unable to do so due to party divisions. Was this the last straw for the prime minister, or were there many others? We invited a guest today to discuss it, journalist and analyst Ralph Scholhammer. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me again.
Okay, so is this a surprise in the Netherlands? Because this guy has had a lot of press in sort of the grander Western press for a long time. So maybe you can give me your reactions to this resignation.
It definitely is a surprise, because whatever one thinks of Mark Rutte, I mean, he has been a survivor in the political scene in the Netherlands for 13 years, as you pointed out at the beginning. Some people tended to call him Teflon Rutte, because no matter how elections ended, somehow he ended up being prime minister. He was supported by Geert Wilders, then he was in a coalition with more left-leaning parties, then with more right-leaning parties. So he was very versatile when it came to staying in power. So my suspicion is, and I guess we're going to talk about this again in a year, I'm not so sure if he's leaving politics altogether or if he's leaving Dutch politics altogether, because the Secretary General of NATO needs to be reassigned next year. Yes. Ursula von der Leyen is going to step down as the head of the European Commission. And those are very, very interesting positions. And within the European establishment, Mark Rutte would be a perfect candidate for both of those positions. Now, personally,
Ursula von der Leyen, did I know this? Because my last notes say she was scheduled to keep her job until 2029. So when was that announced? When did I miss
well,
that?
Well, they were talking about kind of that she switches from the European Commission to becoming Secretary General of NATO. That has been reported by the Telegraph last week. So she doesn't necessarily have to finish out her term. So there could be a kind of a switch that Rutte takes over one of those two positions and then either von der Leyen stays as the head of the European Commission or switches to NATO. So the question then is Rutte going to be staying out of politics altogether, or is he just leaving Dutch politics and moving on to European Union, which at this point, to be honest, I would find more convincing.
Yes, because then we see this chessboard of familiar leaders who have a similar agenda when it comes to, I mean, we could COVID, war, inflation, environment, right? It seems like he checks all the boxes for the agenda. And so this then makes it a question is he ripe for other World Economic Forum positions or other positions for this same platform?
Exactly. So yeah. This is something that's going to come, right? Everybody, this is one of the things where the European Union kind of moves slowly but determinantly in the background, which is who is going to head the next top positions within the EU bureaucracy. Because as we've seen, to give you one quick example, there was a little bit of fallout between the European Parliament regarding a nature restoration law and the European Commission. The bureaucracy ultimately, for now at least, calls the shots within the European Union. So whoever is in charge of the bureaucracy, kind of without any kind of democratic oversight, can actually do a lot of things. So for the Dutch people, to be quite honest, whether those who didn't like Mark Rutte, if they would be better off with him being the head of the European Commission compared to being their prime minister, I'm not entirely sure within the current framework which one of those would be better for the Dutch people.
Right. And so he was able, though, to successfully pull through the charge on the Dutch farmers. You know, that law that said that they were going to take away farms of livestock farmers in certain environmental areas was successfully passed through the European Commission. So there's no reason to think that that agenda would stall, even if he's not in power, right?
No, and there's another thing that makes this all suspicious. I mean, of course, the matter of migration and refugees and this whole topic, this whole complex of different topics, has always been a major issue kind of for the European electorate. But as you just correctly mentioned, Rutte has kind of weathered the storm of the Dutch farmers. I mean, they had significant electoral losses. The Dutch farmer citizen movement, the BBB, has been rising in the polls. Currently, it looks like they might be even the strongest party after the elections. But then all of a sudden, kind of without any previous warning, he would pull the plug of his own leadership over the matter of asylum. That just seems very odd. As you correctly point out, he was in charge for 13 years. So he was responsible for Dutch immigration policy for 13 years. And now all of a sudden they say, I can't do this any longer. I find this very suspicious. He's not too old. He doesn't have any kind of health issues. And it went very quickly. So he had this kind of conversation with his coalition partners, and all of a sudden he threw his arms into the air and said, I can't do this any longer. It's all over. That's not how Dutch politics usually works. So that he's not, again, or maybe he really says, it's possible that he says 13 years has been enough. I'm going to retreat to, well, it's not going to be a farmer, I assume. So he's going to retreat to something else and give some politics.
But farmer, right.
So I don't believe. So I'd be very careful to listen. Well, when he said he's not apparently going to be the major candidate of his party in the elections in the fall. Now, that seems to be clear. But that this is the end of politics for Mark Rutte, I believe it when I see it.
And you would think, given the recent protests and uprising and riots in French-speaking countries, that now is a good time to win on immigration issues. You could successfully step up and say, no, now is the time to limit immigration, and we see why in other places, right? I mean, that was his stance, though, right, to limit asylum seekers and immigration. I don't see why anyone, you know, would not be able to, like a talented enough politician like he seems to be, couldn't get that through.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, he also knows, of course, kind of where the wind is turning within the Dutch electorate. So if he would have had tried to formulate, let's say, a more restrictive course in migration, he could have pushed it through in the coalition. So I don't buy this, that his two small coalition partners were saying that they were so adamant about particularly family reunification, that they more or less brought him down. Nobody's even saying that, right? It was really him. I think they were surprised as well. It was really him who all of a sudden said, I'm out of here. And that just, as I said before, that strikes me more as a reason than a cause. So this strikes me as something. Yeah. He knew that probably the next elections would not end very well for his party. I think he was well aware that maybe this time he could not somehow kind of weasel back into the prime ministerial position. So better to, you know, cut the Gordian knot now and bring himself into a position to be an attractive candidate for either a position within the European Union or a position maybe with the UN or another one of those large international and transnational bodies, than being remembered as the prime minister who lost his final election. So as I said before, I can be wrong here, but politicians usually without a clear reason, a scandal, let's say, or age or health reasons, don't simply end their political careers.
Yeah, we saw that with Jacinda Ardern, right? She was facing...
Exactly.
Yeah, and so this does seem to be a page out of that playbook. We don't know if for sure, but we have seen Jacinda Ardern step up to World Economic Forum positions. So, yeah, okay. Well, I'm going to place your bet there on the bingo game of globalist politicians, I guess, if we call them. And we'll wait and see. Thank you so much for this context. It really helps a lot.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Great to talk to you as always. And you can find Ralf Schollhammer on Twitter. Last time I told you to do that, people had a hard time spelling it out, but we're spelling it on the screen. So you can find him, and I do recommend you follow him. So thanks again for your time.
Always great to be on. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, let us know what you think of that. If you have the globalist bingo card, we really should actually make one up, because who would go on our globalist bingo card? Is, well, Jacinda Ardern, right? She's out. Justin Trudeau is almost like the free space Trudeau. I don't really see him going anywhere in one of these surprise moves, but he will end up somewhere, probably in a power position we don't want him to be in. Who else would be there? Well, Nicola Sturgeon, she's already moved Schultz. Off. Schultz. Olaf Schultz, the Prime Minister of Germany.
What is the girl, Greta Thunberg?
Greta Thunberg, yeah. She's, I mean, Bill Gates has resign. To go on it. Yeah, yes. She can't really, she's not an elected official, but in terms of like, I mean, this guy, we've seen him sort of make these moves, you know, anti-environmentalist moves and reparations for slavery. And like, he's box ticking, right? He's a globalist box ticker. So we'll see where he ends up next. The Ursula von der Leyen movement into a NATO position, that was news to me. That's scary as hell, if I am honest with you about how I feel about it. But let's watch that one. Let's put a pin in it, as I say. Maybe Grimm can make us a real like globalist bingo card. Or maybe not even bingo would be the right thing. It's like a, what's the right way to think of this as a game?
A Venn diagram kind of thing, or a...
yeah.
Just some kind of like, you know, the middle thing and then all of the connections.
Right.
I don't know what you call those.
If we were to bingo card this, yeah. Or like predictions, you know, like who had this, we could, I mean, that would be an easy game to play too. So anyhow, if you can think of a fun game we all can play, I'm in. Let us know in the chat. All right. Well,
we're tail on the globalist.
Plin the tail. Yeah. Or like something super random too, like, you know, globalist baby pairing or whatever, baby news. I don't know.
Grimm suggested in our chat a drinking game. Just every time a globalist tries to take over a new area, you do a shot.
Right. Or faux resignation. Right. Yeah. Like that.
Yeah. There you go.
Then you have the like spend time with my family type of stuff. Like no one wants to do that. They don't want to spend time with their family.
Just an observation though. It's interesting though that like you have these kind of like these European leaders and whatnot like resigning before their scandal hits, and it's like kind of makes me slightly sad in the U.S. Like they just roll right with the scandal and they're like, yeah, I did it, and then they get elected the next election.
Absolutely,
like, Jesus, man, come on.
No political consequences as long as you've got a pretty wife to stand over your shoulder while you do a press conference and say you did that thing, and then you get to keep going. No consequences whatsoever. Well, no consequences for most. All right. We're going to talk about this movie. We're going to be careful talking about this movie about human trafficking. Why the left is creating this truly bizarre narrative about why you shouldn't see it and who are the archetypes that do see it. It's the weirdest thing ever. Plus, we're going to talk about this violent criminal who is speaking out on behalf of trans rights. And I'm going to say it's maybe not the right person to headline your movement, but they're going with it. So we're going to take a look at that. But first, we want to tell you about our friends over at Nom Nom, because your pet is a member of the family. So don't feed them like they're in the doghouse. Give them Nom Nom. Nom Nom delivers fresh dog food with every portion personalized to your dog's needs so you can bring out their very best. You also can customize it to what it is that dog needs. For instance, here's something you wouldn't do with Nom Nom. Just recently, we took Grover into his annual checkup, and the vet noticed that he had gained a kilo, which for an adult dog is a lot because he's little. He's a mini pincher. Turns out I had bought him the puppy version of his food instead of the adult version. So it was bulking him up on purpose. That was my fault. Poor Grover dog was getting the wrong nutrition. That won't happen with Nom Nom because Nom Nom uses the latest science and insights to make real good food for dogs, customized to what your dog needs to make them the healthiest for the longest. Nom Nom already delivered over 40 million meals to good dogs like yours, inspiring millions of clean bowls and wagged tails. So right now for 50% off, you can get your no risk 2-week trial at trynom.com/redacted. Once again, there's the URL on the screen there in the red, trynom.com/redacted. That's nom.com/redacted for 50% off. Once again, trynom.com/redacted for your good dog.
I just want to say that I did that the last time they were our sponsor. I went in and ordered and got my discount, and Pizza absolutely loves the food. And it's pretty cool because you put in the dog's weight, you put in everything, and then they send you the amount that they think you'll need. And it's got like her name all over it and everything. It's really personalized. So it's a pretty cool process.
That's so cute. That's so cute. Yeah. And it's substantial enough, you think, that because she's pretty tiny.
Yeah. And it's real food. Yeah. It's not like you can tell that somebody prepared this as a meal. There's vegetables in it. There's meat. Mm-hmm. And it just looks, it looks like beef stew that I could put in a pot and eat myself.
Yeah. All right. We'll try that next time and see what happens. No, I don't. No. Don't you eat do, the dog food.
No, no.
Do you? We won't judge.
No.
That's
yet.
Only because he doesn't eat vegetables.
Right. Exactly. If there was no corn in it.
Yeah.
Or carrots. Yeah.
All right. Well, very good. It's remember the when we were kids, the commercials of like dogs running, and the I remember there was one where they were like stroking the dog's hair, and I was like, that's not beautiful hair, and it turned out to be a dog. What was that? Remember?
I don't remember that.
Oh, okay. No. Anyway, okay. I can't remember the name of it. Anyway. Okay. Well, let's move on, shall we? Yes. Okay. A new movie called The Sound of Freedom is breaking box office records, but the mainstream media says that it is feeding QAnon conspiracies. So they have devoted entire segments of the news telling you that this movie is just not worth your time. This is a really weird media narrative. The movie here, seen here, called The Sound of Freedom, was released on the 4th of July. It's a movie about the very real and horrifying world of human trafficking and one man's efforts to stop it. We actually have had that man here on the show. You may have seen his name escapes me and I didn't put in my notes. But this is his real story about trying to save kids, like real kids, from slavery. The media is saying, though, yeah, child trafficking, that's bad and that's real. But this is just too much because it validates QAnon, because QAnon cares about human trafficking. It's not just that this movie shines a light on child trafficking. It's just that it's too validating for conspiracy theorists. I mean, what? How can you raise too much awareness about child trafficking? Watch CNN have a guest on and say, yeah, trafficking's a problem, but, you know, come on, we can't, like, validate QAnon conspiracy theorists because it makes people, like, think that they might be right about other things. Watch this baddie say this thing that I can't believe anyone would go on TV and say.
And you seem pretty familiar with him because he doesn't really hide his association with this real wild plot that involves, you know, drinking the blood of children and things like that.
No, he doesn't hide it at all. And you have a lot of people who are in this world of QAnon who say, oh, they don't know what that is. They've never heard of it. They're just asking questions. With somebody like Jim Caviezel, he is openly embracing it. He's openly using its catchphrases and its concepts. He's speaking at QAnon conventions. And this film is being marketed to either specific QAnon believers or to people who believe all of the same tenets as QAnon but claim they don't know what it is.
And The Sound of Freedom does focus on a real issue of sex trafficking. But that theme, it's sort of like that kernel of truth that feeds the QAnon conspiracy theory. Tell us how those two things work together.
Sure. And the most durable and the most believable conspiracy theories are not entirely false. There's something in them that is true and the rest of it is false. But the believers point to the one true thing and they say, oh, you don't believe that this particular thing is true. In terms of child trafficking, we know trafficking is real. We know it has real victims. No one is denying that. But these films are created out of moral panics. They're created out of bogus statistics. They're created out of fear. And with something like Sound of Freedom, it specifically is looking at QAnon concepts of these child trafficking rings that are run by the high-level elites and only people like Tim Ballard and only people like Jim Caviezel and by extension only people like the ticket buyer can help bring these trafficking rings down. So there's a very participatory element. You're not just going to see a movie, you're just killing 2 hours on a hot day. You are helping bring down these pedophile rings and save children. Now, it's not true, but it's a very comforting and it's a very warm feeling to have.
Okay. He's an idiot. Yeah. Because, first of all, it's so rich that they let him say that these things are created out of moral panic, bogus statistics, and fear. Rewind the clock, CNN, since 2020, and review how you presented the pandemic. And then tell me about moral panic, bogus statistics, and fear. First of all, I cannot believe the lack of self-awareness that you would say, yes, there's child trafficking, but this is giving moral panic. Is there anything else in the world to give moral panic that is more justified for moral panic? Do you think?
Well, then think about the media's job. Like he's sitting there saying, oh, you know, with every conspiracy, there's some truth to it. So there's some truth to this, but let's overlook that little piece of truth that we should go deeper and invest. If there is a little ounce of truth, then that's a journalist's job is to go deeper and find more of the truth and actually add something to the story, not just write it off like, we don't care about the little truths in there. We only care about, you know, how it's going to be perceived by a certain group of people.
But if the linchpin here is child trafficking, shouldn't you then, instead of say what is not true about this or what may be like anxiety ridden, but like talk about what is true and what does need to be done, not that you should ignore this movie because it may scare you too much and you're not doing anything. So let's just focus on the movie. It's such a navel-gazing way to be. Go ahead, Philip. I'm sorry. I'm cutting you off.
Well, I would be curious to go back and see how CNN covered like Ashton Kutcher, because he is a huge advocate against, you know, like for child or like human trafficking. I wonder if they like go back and look at, you know, if you go back at their previous coverage of that, if they say that he's just feeding into the QAnon conspiracy too. Like it's not the argument falls apart when it's very clear that they have an agenda off the bat, you know, that CNN has an agenda.
Right. Yeah.
Well, and another thing that I found funny is like he mentioned getting out of the heat on a hot day and watching the movie. Jennifer, and I've seen this happening all around the country. There's stories of this, but Jennifer knew someone personally that bought tickets to go to see that movie and they refunded her ticket without her asking. And then when she called, they said, yeah, the air conditioner's not working. However, all the other movies were playing. It just happened to be that specific movie where that was that the air conditioner was supposedly broke. And she said, well, can I come watch it anyway? And they said, well, yeah, sure. So then she went in and watched it anyway and said there was like four people there. So it's like they made up this story that the air conditioner and didn't work, refunded everybody's tickets, and that's happening around the country.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you another story that's similar to that that's been reported online. It's very suspicious about the idea of getting people to not watch this movie. But before we're done with that, before we get to those stories, let's look at another media narrative, which is crazy. Here's Rolling Stone saying that it's a superhero movie for dads with brain worms. Says it's QAnon-tinged thriller about child trafficking is designed to appeal to the conscience of a conspiracy-addled boomer. So not only is the kind of person that watches this a QAnon nut, but they're also, I guess, hyper-masculine and old. They describe this actually in the next screen, which I just couldn't believe that they would say this. I'm going to have to read it to you because it's so crazy. You know, they talk about Ballard, Jen Caviezel, the lead. We'll get to that. But look at the last sentence of this paragraph. It says, in short, this reviewer says, I was at the movies with people who were there to see their worst fears confirmed. Sound of Freedom lives up to that in anticipation. It's a stomach-turning experience, fetishizing the torture of child victims and lingering over lush preludes to their abuse. At times, I had the uncomfortable sense that I might be arrested myself just for sitting through it. Nonetheless, the mostly white-haired audience around me could be relied on to gasp, moan in pity, mutter condemnations, applaud, and bellow amen at moments of righteous fury, such as when Ballard declares that God's children are not for sale. They were entranced by what they clearly took for a searing expose. Not even the occasional nasty coughing fit, and we had no shortage of those, could break the spell. This is an incredibly ageist way to talk about the film, not only like about how the film is salacious, and other reviewers have said that it's not salacious. It does not like linger on some of the more disturbing parts of this unnecessarily. What they're saying is, why else would you go there unless you're old, crotchety, and want to have your worst fears confirmed? Go ahead, David.
Yeah, and it's like, if you're a movie reviewer, you're going to review the audience. Like, I'm only here to review the audience score. Like, what do the audience do? I don't care. I'm not even going to talk about the movie. Not one thing about the movie. It's all about the audience. And I just,
like, I'm better than them because I'm not old and wheezing and Christian saying amen. I mean, could you like think about, you can make that argument about any other movie audience that has any kind of moral lesson, like climate apocalypse or movies about race, right? Or movies about nuclear fallout. I mean, can you think of like, imagine for a second that this is being said about a progressive film that maybe, you know, the media likes as a narrative. Like if you played this out with the color purple and like, oh, you know, only people who like to whine about racial prejudice go to the color purple. And I was in the theater with lots of black people who were acting black, or upper class, you know, New Jersey Democrats with their kids who were posting on Facebook about how they took their kids to see a movie about slavery to keep it real. Right. You would never do that. It's incredibly offensive. Like you don't. So they're like making fun of an archetype for a reason in a way that like ignores the fact that children here are victims. It's so morally repugnant and offensive. And I'm just so curious about the idea that there's just too much awareness of child trafficking. Like, we really don't need that. I mean, again, what Death Eater would say, like, too much awareness again about this? As if you're, like, afraid of disrupting. I mean, as if, right? As if you're afraid of disrupting the child trafficking industry. Meaning, if you're not against it, you're kind of for it, right? I mean, that is there any other conclusion?
No. And that's the thing. Like, you have people arguing this with no, like, they're not even touching on the movie. Like, the depth of the movie, what's in the movie, the child trafficking itself, they're so focused on who it's connecting with, the QAnon and stuff. But it's like, everything you make or do is going to connect with a maybe an element of people you wouldn't necessarily make it for, but it's like all the other people that it's resonating with, for what reason? Why is it resonating with them? Let's talk about that. I'm actually going to see that movie tonight, so I'll have a little bit more context after, but.
All right. I'm going to have to wait for it to stream because it's not here in Europe. But also because Clayton's gone, I wouldn't watch that alone. I would get too much in a dark place. And, you know, I'll read any kind of like dark book. But then when it comes to seeing things visually, I can't take it by myself. Now, despite all of this, the movie has done really well and beat box office expectations. It earned $18 million in its opening weekend and took the number three spot at the box office. It even beat Indiana Jones, which is a truly heinous movie, on 4th of July.
I didn't know you knew that. I was going to say, you'll be happy to know it beat Indiana Jones.
Yeah. Indiana Jones was terrible.
And in the redacted conversation that Clayton did with Tim Ballard, was it like a month ago, 3 weeks ago, something like that? They actually talked at the end of it about, you know, they needed this to beat Indiana Jones at the box office, and success.
Oh, I missed that part. Okay, that escaped me. That was not hard to do because that was one of the worst movies ever. My children were like, can we leave during the car chases? Because they just drag on so long and you're supposed to buy that a tuk-tuk can like keep up with a regular car. And they were just, I posted this on Twitter. I was like, afterwards, my kids were like, I can see now why they killed off Han Solo. Sorry if I spoiled anything there. they killed off Han Solo because we don't need any more movies.
Wait, what?
Like that.
Yes. If you still don't know that, you deserve the spoiler. Okay. I'm just going to throw that out there.
That's like a 5-year spoiler. So I think we're good on that one. Now I want to circle back around to the point that David made earlier, is that a lot of moviegoers are saying that they're having really strange experiences of tickets canceled, air conditioning turned off. Here is the woman who runs the Libs of TikTok account. She gives this 2-minute sort of review, and she says that also happened to her, where she went to the theater and there was a big disruption and a lot of people were sort of discouraged from seeing the movie. Watch what she has to say.
Hi everyone. So last night I went to watch the Sound of Freedom movie. And it's very interesting because CNN and Rolling Stone and Washington Post and The Guardian, they were all publishing articles about how the movie is like related to QAnon and conspiracy theories. So that alone told me that this is something that they don't want you to watch, which is why you should definitely go watch it. Additionally, I also saw some reporting of people who were saying that weird things were happening when they were trying to go see it in theaters. Like the air conditioning wasn't working or their tickets were canceled. And when I went, a couple minutes into the movie, the fire alarm went off. The entire building had to evacuate. And about 15, 20 minutes later, it was resolved and we were able to go back in and resume the movie. But we were missing half the audience now. But I did stay until the end, and the movie is excellent. It was educational and inspiring and eye-opening. I was not even aware of the extent of the child sex trafficking industry until I watched this. The U.S. is in the top 3 countries for destinations for child sex trafficking victims. It's a $150 billion a year industry, and there are millions, tens of millions of children who are currently trapped in sex slavery. So it's heart-wrenching. There were people in the audience who were moved to tears, and really inspiring too, because at the end, I know for myself, I left and I was like, what can I do to help raise awareness about this? What can I do to help these children? So I'm passing on the message. I hope you do too. Go see the movie. It's a must watch. Bring your family, bring your friends, tell everyone you know, go watch Sound of Freedom. Something has to be done about it. Something really drastic.
So she says people in the theater were moved to tears. Although Rolling Stone tells us, don't worry about them. They were old people who cough a lot. I don't know. I guess it's so funny. We were supposed to care about old people during the pandemic, you know, stay home, stay away from them, take the vaccine to protect them. We're not supposed to care about them now. if they care about child trafficking, and you're not supposed to either. So anyway, yes, I have not seen this movie yet, but I am here to break down just the narrative around it, because if you're the person saying ignore child trafficking because it's linked to other narratives that I don't like and I don't want people to know, you're the bad guy. The conversation here is maybe what this movie got wrong and what we all can do about hurting children. That doesn't seem to be a priority for the mainstream media. It's horrific. So let me know what you think of that in the chat below, and whether or not you'll see the movie. All right. We have one more story to get to tonight. I see you still, if you joined us late, you realized it's just Natalie this week again. Clayton is still off. He will be back next Monday. And I will make him do double work, because then I will get time off for time served. It's a lot to put this show together by myself. I am glad that I don't do it on a regular basis and that we have someone. Because a lot of times we see in the chat, you know, we take turns presenting two stories a night. And so sometimes I see your comments like, why is it just her? How come he's not talking? He's not here today. And if you see a piece when he is here, it's usually because that was my piece. But he will be back. He has another week to himself. And then he will be right there. So thank you for saying that you miss him. And I've passed along the messages, and he maybe is in the chat. I don't know. Has anybody seen Clayton in the chat? Anybody?
I have not.
You haven't? Okay. I'm sure
I'm usually too busy. I'm too busy to read chat while the show's going.
Well, good for you. That's good. That's probably the good thing to do. I try and keep an eye on it, though. Okay. Well, it's like he's like an Easter egg if he says something in the chat. He doesn't really like it when we sort of make fun, like, oh, he's on the moon or taken by aliens, because he likes, you know, he doesn't like it when news anchors make fun of that kind of stuff. So I won't say that. I don't know. It's like a where in the world is Matt Lauer, but not. Do you remember that?
But if you do want to see Clayton, there is that redacted conversation that's going live right after the show. So
about 3 p.m. Which one Pacific. Is it?
That's the one with Niara Isley. So
okay.
Check it out.
All right. Yes. Check that out. Okay. Well, we're going to talk about this trans rally that happened in London this weekend with thousands of people. Very strange choice they made for one of their speakers on the platform. And we're going to tell you about that and whether or not the Metropolitan Police will have to get involved in this person's actions. But first, we want to tell you about our show sponsor over at Bird Dogs, because Bird Dogs make you look good. They are stretch khaki shorts that are designed to fit slimmer through the thighs and leg, giving you that truly sculpted look. So it doesn't look like you're wearing, you know, the idea of parachute pants. You're not supposed to look like a parachute. You want them to actually be slimming and show that you've got a human body. Bird Dogs shorts do the same thing as Lululemon, but fit way better. They fit better than regular shorts that are made of stiff, restricting cotton. Bird Dogs fixed this issue by inventing cloud knit fabric that looks like khaki, but stretches so you get that slimmer fit without having to sacrifice movement. Bird Dogs uses anti-stink, sweat-wicking fabric that keeps you cool and dry all day long, so you can show yourself and your friends just how ready you are for summer with your super fit and super well-fit khakis. Khaki-like shorts and pants. So right now, go to birddogs.com/redacted and enter promo code redacted. You'll get a free Yeti-style tumbler with your order, and you'll get actually really good-looking pants. Again, these are like the Lululemon for guys. Really comfortable pants you're not going to want to take off and move from day to night or whatever it is you're up to. Again, that's birddogs.com/redacted, or use promo code redacted for that free Yeti style tumbler. You won't want to take your Bird Dogs off. We promise you. That's birddogs.com/redacted. All right. Well, you would think that a convicted kidnapper and attempted murderer may not be your best spokesperson for a movement, right? But that's what happened this weekend at London's Trans Pride event. And now some people are understandably concerned about this. Sarah Jane Baker is a trans activist who took to the stage on Saturday and advocated for punching TERFs in the effing face. I decided not to show you this video because we're just not sure how YouTube will react to it, whether or not that would get us punished. But that is a exact quote, that if you see any TERFs, punch them in the effing face. She didn't say effing. They used the whole word. TERF, you know, is an acronym for Trans Exclusionary Radical Feminist. It's a fetishized academic way for saying a woman who does not accept men into their groups, biological men, and excludes them from biological spaces. This is a call for violent misogyny. It's a call for violence against women because they have an opinion about their own spaces, biological women. So this is Sarah Jane Baker over the weekend with a megaphone. Do you notice anything about this besides the way this person looks that may be a cause for concern? We're going to get back to that. This is like one of those find me questions.
I mean, one thing I notice is that not many of the crowd are even looking their way.
Okay. Yes. That is one thing. I also would like to point your attention to the Antifa flag, but we're going to circle back around to that. Sarah Jane Baker is seen here as a young man when his name was Alan Baker, the violinist. Now, before transitioning in prison, Baker was convicted for kidnapping and torturing his stepmother's brother, so I guess step-uncle, was only sentenced to 9 years, but then had that sentence extended because while in a men's prison, he broke into another inmate's cell and tried to strangle him to death. Then in 2017, while still in prison, Baker says that he cut off his own testicles. I have no proof of that, and I did not look into it any further. You will forgive me for not. He said that. He did that. He also said while in prison, he dealt drugs and did sex work. But still in 2019, the government of England decided to start giving him estrogen and a £10,000 taxpayer-funded sex reassignment surgery. On taxpayer dollars. Now, again, we're choosing not to show you the video where Baker says to find TERFs and punch them in the face because it could get us punished on YouTube. But let's look at Baker again in this image and get a closer look at the Antifa flag. Antifa is a movement that, unlike the QAnon piece that we just did, the media would very much like to pretend that Antifa doesn't exist because Antifa is an extremist left-wing group, and it is very real, and it is violent, and they very much do want people who don't agree with their way of thinking to be punished with violence. They think that words are violent, so they have to be violent. Again, this is someone who was able to speak and represent this group at the trans rally in London this weekend. Here's a picture of the rally where hundreds, if not thousands, came out to support trans rights. In fact, London Mayor Sadiq Khan supported this event. But when asked about this, he said violence is never acceptable. And that was about it. Now the Metropolitan Police said that they will investigate this formally. You know, again, if a man, a biological man in a crowded space says find biological women and punch them and advocates for violence and misogyny against women, what should happen? What is an appropriate thing to do if that person were not wearing a dress? What would we do? You know, a related case about this kind of thing is when this actually did happen because of this language. Now, you might want to say it's just a rhetoric. They don't really mean it. It doesn't really happen. Well, it does. In 2017, a 61-year-old woman named Maria McLaughlin was assaulted by a trans person named Tara Wolf. This is said trans person, biological male, who came to this trans rally knowing that gender critical feminists would be there. McLaughlin was just there to take pictures, but Tara Wolf decided to punch her in the face. Before leaving for the rally, Tara Wolf wrote on Facebook, "I want to F up some TERFs. They're no better than fascists." They meant it, and they went out there and did it. This case went to court, and even though McLaughlin won the case and Wolf was found guilty of assault, I think she broke her nose or something like that. I don't remember exactly, but it was like enough of an assault to take it to court. The judge reprimanded McLaughlin, the victim, for not referring to her assailant as a she. The judge also denied financial compensation because she would not use female pronouns for the male person who punched her in the face. So she was denied any kind of reparations or financial compensation because she continued to insist the person who just punched me was a male. And that makes a difference, because if a female punches me, that will probably feel one way. But if a full-grown man punches me, that's much different. I'm going to feel a whole lot different. I mean, of course, depending on the female, right? But this person was assaulted. Now, you would assume that Sarah Jane Baker, the person we talked about earlier, has some release conditions since that 30-year conviction was served. Is this a violation? Who knows? As for the trans rally organizers, they were asked, you know, hey, do you really want to have this violent thing be out there as something that represents you? Here is their statement. They don't really have a problem with it. Organizers said, Sarah and many others in our community hold a lot of rage and anger that they have the right to express that anger through their words. So this is appropriate anger. Again, you would also assume that men who call to punch women in the face would somehow face consequences in public life, but not if that man wears a dress and performs woman face. So we're taking bets on what the Met will do with this new investigation. Shocking enough that they opened it at all. So any thoughts on this, David? Oh, no, sorry, you're talking.
No. I just feel like, you know, that it's just getting continuing to get more and more dangerous because the physical threats are increasing. And I just feel like, you know, at the end of the day, like, it's because of all this affirmation that they're getting. They're getting so affirmed by everybody. And there's this big group of people that keep affirming all of this stuff. And it's just making it worse because now they're feeling like they're bulletproof and can say and do whatever they want. And it's just going to continue to get more dangerous. So it freaks me out.
Yes. But I do think that it's the media's job, or at least us in the media, to talk about sort of all types of extremism. And Antifa is absolutely an extremist movement. It has a disproportionate number of transgender members or people who are speaking on behalf of transgender. And that movement feels like violence is an acceptable way to react to wrong think. And so soon the media will have to acknowledge that. I mean, even I was telling a friend of mine, because I read Andy Ngo's book about Antifa. My friend's like, that's real. I thought it was just a right-wing conspiracy a right-wing conspiracy, like saying Antifa is like extreme. Yes, it's real. It's absolutely real. Well, and it's dangerous.
What's also frustrating is when you look at like this movie that's out, and what they're focused on is QAnon, QAnon, QAnon. They will go off on QAnon. They will stop their bank accounts, Proud Boys, all that other stuff.
Yeah.
But they don't do anything like that to Antifa. And I would argue Antifa is worse because they actually go out and seek the violence. You know, most of the Proud Boys stuff, the attacks and everything that have happened have been self-defense against Antifa. Like, so it's like, how are they not labeled the same and criticized the same as QAnon or the Proud Boys and things like that? You don't hear their bank accounts getting closed down and stuff on Twitter.
Yeah, I suppose. I don't know. I don't know about that. I don't know about right-wing violence being a reaction. I mean, there's definitely instigated violence on both sides, right? And they deserve equal consideration. Yeah. Yeah,
exactly. Right.
Yeah. But I mean, there are many accounts of the media just absolutely ignoring Antifa related violence, Antifa related. I mean, Antifa, you know, if the media really wanted to, Antifa could be a very scary boogeyman because of the sort of way that they, you know, bring umbrellas, that they're trained to use everyday objects as violence. For instance, like milkshakes made of cement type of things, you know, the covering of the faces, the sort of, there's a lot to be afraid of in equal measure of any extremist movement. But the media doesn't want to. So, you know, is this worth a segment of just somebody screaming, you know, let's punch them all in the face? Is it like, oh, well, they're just saying that? Or is it indicative of our, requiring our attention because it is rallying. I mean, when she says this in the video, we're choosing not to show you, people cheer. Like, yes, absolutely. We are for this, right? You would hope that if it were a peaceful movement, people would be like, well, no, not that, right? We're talking about human rights issues here. We're not a violent movement. This is not what we stand for. But no, that there was full-throated cheers.
And I was going to say, like, imagine if someone attacked J.K. Rowling. They would be cheering that on because she's like the queen turf at this point. And they would be cheering that on, and that would be a good thing to a lot of those people. And that just, like, that's one of the things I'm talking about that freaks me out. It's like, it's moving toward that. I think that if any of them saw her out, fortunately, she's kind of a recluse in a way, I think, that they would do that to her. And I think that that's only going to get worse the more that they get that kind of reaction from people. They're like, oh, we're bulletproof. We're not getting any flack. We're not getting any, everybody's like celebrating the fact that we're calling for violence.
Yeah. Someone in the chat started with a Y, just pointed out that Antifa has roots in Nazi Germany. And that's true. This is absolutely true. And it's worth our attention. You know, like QAnon is like, oh, so funny, throwaway extremist nuts. Like, again, all extremism requires our attention. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I refer to him as Klantifa because I just feel like it's a different colored robe is all it is. Because it's the same thing. You know, at the end of the day, it's the same mentality as the Klan.
Yes. Yeah, very much so. I'm thinking of this story that Andy Ngo tells in his book. I can't remember the name of the book right now. He tells about this guy who, like, divorces his wife. They have a small child, and is really substance addicted, ends up having an affair with someone in his another man in the Antifa group, and then decides that he is either gay or transgender or some like form of that, highly anxietized, can't function in normal conversations without bringing up these extremist theories, paranoid and anxietized, and then ended up having some kind of shootout at a school because had been radicalized all the way down, like through this tunnel of sexual deviance and in through this extremism. And yeah, these stories, you know, you can sort of make a parallel of extremists on both sides of like someone who just no longer can function in society without being obsessed with their conspiracies and their theories and their, you know, sort of new life paradigms, and feels like everyone is screwed because they can't see what they see. You can make this parallel on both sides. And if the media just chooses a side, right, then we're equally in danger. So let us know what you think of this in the chat. I do recommend the book, the Andy Ngo book on that. And it was interesting because I didn't know about this QAnon book of the person we did in the previous segment. And I was like, well, maybe I should read that too. Like I'm interested in learning about, you know, all types of extremists, but I don't think I could buy that guy's book now that he's told us that like child trafficking is not worthy of our attention. So if you have a different book on a QAnon that you think I should read, I'll read it because I read everything pretty much that comes across my way. So
you should share your book club because I think people could follow you over there.
Yeah, you can find me on Goodreads. I just read a book this weekend that I really was interested in. I want to have the author on the show. It's called Let There Be Water, about how Israel has a surplus of water because Israel, when it was founded in 1948, realized we're going to be screwed here in the desert because we're kind of diplomatically alone and we're always at war with somebody. So we cannot rely on foreign imports of food and water. And we're in the desert and this population is going to grow. So we better figure out our water situation and we better not let politics muck it up for us. And so Israel has so much water, they can export it in the desert despite normal drought cycles, which is what we have. So climate change or, you know, drought cycles will not affect Israel's water supply for four different reasons. One, I think there are four. One is that they removed politics from altogether. Like politicians don't just say stuff about water. Like it's really, it's not privatized. It's a public commodity. So Philip has mentioned a few times certain places where you can't collect rainwater because the water is public commodity. That's true in Israel. If you collect rainwater, like it literally, water belongs to everybody. You can't just drill on your own property. Water is more expensive there because they pay the real price. In the United States, we don't pay for water. We only pay for the cost of delivering water to your house. Also, they can reuse their sewage water. They've realized how to treat that and use it for farming in a safe way. They are actively working to remove hormones and antibiotics from the water, which is something that the United States belly aches about but does nothing about. And what's the fourth, the thing they, oh, they know how to use desalinization, and they use, no, this is way more than four. And an Israeli person is actually who came up with drip farming. So they don't do flood farming and they don't waste water that way. So they literally have more water than they can use as a population. So when global governments tell you that like a drought is your fault, it's really not. It's government's fault. If a government decides that like our lives depend on this, because they do, they can solve it. They just won't for many different reasons. Anyway, fantastic book. You can find me on Goodreads at Natalie Morris. I think it's, yeah, just Natalie Morris, where I post everything that I'm reading. That was not a segment I intended to do, just a book I wanted to talk about. And I'm interested in talking to this author because, again, this narrative that like climate change is your fault and that you can change it, it has to be innovation and government to solve these water supply crisis. That's really just it. So that was my book review for today. Thank you, Sefaradine, for posting my Goodreads in the chat on Rumble. I appreciate that very much. So I will be back here tomorrow. Clayton will not. You only have three more solo shows with me. We can get through it. I hope you don't mind. I appreciate your comments very much. And I will see you here tomorrow. Again, make sure that you're subscribed to the newsletter. Hit that like and subscribe button if you don't mind, whatever platform you're on.